Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. Today is Friday, July 13th, 2018, and the first segment of the program, I am live today. We're going to go over the market report, and we have James Corbett for the second and third segment of today's program. And it's a real interesting interview. I do enjoy talking to James, and so please stay tuned, and I'm sure you'll enjoy those segments also. And also, you can visit his website, thecorbettreport.com, and of course, theinternationalforecaster.com. Please ask for a complimentary issue of the International Forecaster. So, but let's get started anyway. And again, it is Friday, July 13th, 2018. And let's go ahead and go to the gold prices. And yes, we've had some additional pressure on gold today, down another $1,241.70. Silver, a lot of silver buyers out there today, down 15 cents at $15.88. Platinum down $13 at $831, and yeah, palladium down 12 at $942. The USDX is a little weaker, down 0.09 at 94.74. Crude oil is a little stronger, up 0.43 at 70.76. We'll talk both a little bit about the dollar and oil here in just a few moments. And let me get to the paper markets today. We have the Dow currently up 93 points at 25,018. The NASDAQ is up 2 at 7,825. The S&P is up 3 at 2,801. 10-year yield 2.83%, down 0.02. Euro's a little stronger today at 117. And European and Asian markets, particularly Japan, was much stronger overnight. And let's see. Well, let's see what the Bitcoin was down just a tad today at 61.35, down a little over 0.5%. So that's it for the markets. Again, all eyes have been on either the testimony from the Democrats, on everybody's watching from the Hill, and Mr. Trump, President Trump in Europe, following his every move. And but we're going to stay a little bit focused here. We did see the dollar again slip just barely against the basket of currencies today, but it did fade from a two-week peak. And of course, a lot of that was tied to news of a record Chinese trade surplus that may fuel the U.S.-China trade tensions, and that briefly spurred safe havens bids for the dollar. Paresh, I'm not even going to try to pronounce his last name, U-P-A-D-H-Y-A-Y-A. So I'm not even going to attempt it. But he is a currency strategist, director of currency strategy at Amundi Pioneer Investments in Boston. And he says it's really hard to see what's going to dethrone the dollar at this point. You have trade war concerns sort of amplify the downside risk on global growth. And that tends to be positive for the dollar. It puts a drag on other currencies, and we're certainly experiencing that. And again, I think we have the pressure on the commodities as perhaps a downside risk on global growth. We certainly seen some huge drops in palladium and platinum, and I do believe that has a tendency to pull down also the gold and silver, because no one is really talking about the debt, but we are here in just a few minutes. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, he said yesterday that the United States and China might reopen some trade talks, briefly easing concerns about the trade dispute. And of course, we've seen the markets react. But the data is still showing that China's trade surplus with the United States swelled to a record in June. And of course, we know the U.S. President Donald Trump this week pledged to impose tariffs on $200 billion more in Chinese imports. Of course, Beijing has vowed to retaliate. Escalating trade tensions have not dented the U.S. economy, which is on its second longest expansion on record. And of course, we talked about this yesterday about, you know, China only has so many, doesn't have as many products to retaliate on. because they don't buy that much from the United States. But they can use the dollar as leverage, and they could also use oil as leverage. So I think those are far more powerful than putting 25% tariffs on something on products. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. We'll see if Beijing actually does retaliate to the point they're having difficulties. And you know, it's really amazing because everybody talks about, oh, the emerging markets, you know, their currencies are being devastated, and Beijing and China, they're having problems and issues. Amazing. I mean, we're connected. If you ever want to talk about a contagion from other countries, I don't think we are really, isolated from any other country in this world anymore, when it comes to their economies and having it filtered down. It's not going to stop in their countries. There will be contagions, and perhaps it might hit Europe first. It might, but it's coming if these other countries can't improve, and there isn't some sort of a stem on their currency devaluations, as we have seen of late. We have these. The Fed's released its semi-annual report on monetary policy. We have the Jerome Powell. He's to testify to Congress next Tuesday and Wednesday, and I don't think there's going to be any surprises there. The report showed that the U.S. economic growth is solid, and they're going to continue to keep raising rates gradually. I said we were going to talk a little bit about oil today. We saw oil prices rise about 1% today. There is a strike in Norway, and Iraq hits which Iraq will hit supplies, but futures were set for a second straight week of decline after Libyan ports reopened and on the view that Iran might still export some crude despite the U.S. sanctions. You had hundreds of workers on the Norwegian offshore oil and gas rigs. They went on strike on Tuesday. They rejected a proposed wage deal, closing Shell's NAR field. It produces about 23,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day. In Iraq, about 100 protesters are demanding jobs and better services from Iraq's leaders. They closed access to the Qusair commodities port near the southern city of Basra on Friday. Persistently declining oil supplies from Venezuela and simmering strike actions in Norway and Iraq, they're prompting bullish sentiment. And so we're going to see prices, which we did earlier this week, weakened after OPEC member Libya, they reopened their major eastern oil ports. And U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Washington would consider granting waivers to some of Iran's crude buyers. So it just goes to show you how important that Strait of Hormuz is. And it's interesting to see that Washington decided to back down, that they would actually grant waivers to some of Iran's crude buyers. So fears that a U.S.-China trade dispute could also hit global economic growth, of course, have also kept buyers on the back foot. You have Russia, you have other leading oil producers may boost oil output further as supply shortages hit the market. You have the Russian Energy Minister Alexander Novak. He said that in June. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and other key producers, including Russia, responded to market tightness by easing a supply cut agreement. So you even had China's crude oil imports. They fell for a second month in a row in June to their lowest since December. It's going to be real interesting to see what Russia does, after the, statements about Germany and Russia and exporting the natural gas to Germany. And also, I guess, in the big headlines today, At least I saw. I didn't have a chance. Like I said, people were busy purchasing gold and silver today, where the Russian military is charged with hacking the DNC, the Hillary campaign, state elections. We'll just have to see how this is all playing out. But those are the big red headlines that's floating around. So we'll see how these impacts, if any, for the oil. Something that's I'm not going to say near and dear to my heart, but it's just amazing. The federal government collected another record, $1.3 trillion. It's actually $1,305,490,000 in individual income taxes through the first 9 months of fiscal 2018, which is October 2017 through June 2018. And of course, this is according to the monthly Treasury statement that was released today. However, despite the record individual income tax collections, the federal government still ran a deficit of $607 billion. Almost a tr over a half a trillion, almost $1 trillion over those same 9 months. The approximately $1.3 trillion in individual income taxes that the Treasury collected in October through June of this fiscal year was 71, almost $72 billion more than the $1.2 trillion that was in individual income taxes that the Treasury collected in fiscal 2017. And that was a record. That was the previous record. So, although the federal government collected record individual income taxes in the first 9 months of this year, overall federal tax collections were lower in the first 9 months of this fiscal year than they were in any of the previous five fiscal years, including 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, and 2017. In October through June of this year, the Treasury collected $2.5 trillion in total taxes, and that was down almost, let's see, a little over $39 billion than what they collected in 2017, the first 9 months of the fiscal year. So, again, this is the tax reform. Individuals pay more. We get collected more. And the federal tax collections are actually lower. Corporations, of course, income tax collections has also been declining this year. In the first 9 months of 2018, the fiscal 2018, the Treasury collected $161 billion in corporation income. And of course, that is $67 billion less than the 229, and I'm rounding these numbers out, than the $229 billion in corporation income taxes in the first 8 months of fiscal 2017. So, hey, the tax reform for the corporations is working. Yes, it is. I wonder if it's working for you. I wonder if it's working for the middle class. And if it is working, I wonder if it's working enough. So again, it doesn't seem like it with those numbers that they gave us. These are record income taxes to the first 9 months, $1.3 trillion. I guess the world is great. I guess our economy is doing great, but yet we still have a deficit. We're going to talk a little bit about debt because I believe if you're looking to see what's really going to actually have an impact on the greatest bubble that ever was, the granddaddy of all bubbles, and its debt. The world now has some $247 trillion in debt. The U.S. would be paying. Let's go on. I'm going to go on. By the time the mid-90s rolled around, the United States financial system was so saturated with debt that the Federal Reserve opted to start intentionally creating asset bubbles to stop debt deflation. We saw this in the late 90s. You had the tech bubble. When that burst, and there was bubbles before that, but they were minor at that point in time. So let's begin with those that people remember the most and had the biggest impacts, and that was really the 90s with the tech bubble. When that burst, the Fed opted to create the housing bubble, and that is a more senior asset class. And as a result, in the mid-2000s, we had the housing bubble. When that bubble burst, the Fed opted to create a bubble in the U.S. Treasuries. This is the most senior asset class in the entire system, representing the risk-free rate of return against which all risk is valued. And the Fed had opted to create a bubble in the financial system. This is the bedrock of the financial system. And by doing this, literally everything went into bubble mode. And of course, this is the granddaddy of all bubbles, and it's debt. And we've seen, you know, the yields in treasuries, they have broken their long-term 20-year trend line. And, you know, this entire debt bubble requires interest rates to remain low just for it to be maintained. So if we begin to see these bond yields, and the feds, they keep saying that these yields are going to rise, they're going to continue to raise rates, the bond prices are going to collapse. And this is the bedrock of the financial system, of the world financial system. But no one really knows what is the catalyst that's really going to break this, that's really going to break the bubble, that's going to pop the bubble. And, you know, we talk a little bit about it when I interviewed James Corbett. He talks about what Japan is doing and how they're going to continue to stimulate their economy by debt. And it really is an incredible time to see what is going to happen to all of these economies around the world to actually collapse all at once. And it's interesting to see people being so positive. And as we said in the interview, it's not that we want something bad to happen. I said this yesterday with Pastor Butch, probably the day before, probably a month before. We don't want bad things to happen. We just want you to be prepared and to understand how and why this is going to come undone. So you're prepared, and that's what it's all about, is being prepared. And I'm just about prepared to go into the first break of the program today. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Silver Eagles are a buy. Gold Eagles are a buy. $20 gold pieces are a buy with these low, low prices. Give us a call. Don't wait. And we're heading into this break. I hear the music. Please stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm pleased to welcome James Corbett to the program today. As you know, James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report, and also the lead editorial writer for the International Forecaster. And of course, the International Forecaster is the weekly e-newsletter that was created by the recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. And you can visit James's work at thecorbettreport.com, thecorbettreport.com, and also you can go to theinternationalforecaster.com and request a complimentary issue. So please do that. I encourage you to do that. And hello, James.
Well, hello, Melody. Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. And so let's get started right away. Prior to the show, I don't know if this is for airing, but I know there's a lot of followers, a lot of my listeners, our listeners, they follow what QAnon is. And I guess they, you know, there's a lot of followers, and it's sort of interesting. I watched a video this evening, and seems legit, but being the skeptic that I am, I just wanted to know what your thoughts were.
Well, for people who don't know, this comes from the image board culture of 4chan and 8chan and other places like that online, some of the dark corners of the web, as it were. And this follows in the tradition that has been established recently of different types of anons, i.e. anonymous commenters on those boards that claim to have special government insider access. So there was an FBI anon a couple of years ago that was talking about various things related to the Clinton investigation and things like that. So here we have this QAnon that showed up a year and a half ago, something like that, and started giving information that was that seems to suggest some sort of inside information coming from the White House itself. And I have looked into this enough to know that the refrain that this QAnon character likes to use, "Trust the plan," is absolutely not for me. I certainly share your idea that that skepticism should be reserved for any such thing like this, especially an anonymous commenter on some image board on the internet claiming to be part of the White House that for some reason or other is leaking these important details to people so that they can trust the White House. I mean, that goes against every grain, every fiber of my being, that I'm just going to simply accept that information and go, okay, well, there's a plan and it's happening, so we're all happy. And this relates to all sorts of different ideas that are floating around now about all of these sealed indictments. There are 50,000 sealed indictments now, and it's all going to be released, and they're going to round up the Clintons and everyone, and the whole deep state is going down. I'll believe it when I see it. I will not trust a plan by some entity online claiming to have some sort of insider information that's just telling me to trust a politician. Not as far as I can throw them.
You know, I've been around during this venue for, 23, 24 years, and, it just happens continuously. Someone pops up, and particularly out of nowhere. They just pop up out of nowhere. And when I see someone pop up out of nowhere and you don't know who they are, I guarantee it's government.
I think that's likely... part of this is that, yeah, it might be someone with actual inside information, but they might not be on your side, and you should always keep that possibility in mind.
And I wasn't saying that it's always government as a positive, more of a negative, but
of course.
I didn't know.
I understood that.
I didn't know that. I didn't realize that the 4chan and the, was is that from the deep or the dark web?
Well, no, it's not part of the they call the dark web, where you have to, you know, use a Tor or some other thing to access it. It is openly available online, but it is it has a reputation for being a sort of lawless corner of the internet, where back in the day, I think it was associated with a lot of illegal content, child pornography and things like that. It has, I believe, since cleaned up its act. You're not likely to find that sort of content on there anymore, but you still find some pretty crazy stuff on there, including this type of anon phenomenon where the FBI anon and QAnon and things like this.
Well, on Wednesday, the big news was the NATO summit. President Donald Trump made headlines, and he told UN Secretary General Guterres that Germany is totally controlled by Russia. Trump was referring to Germany's deal with Russia regarding the construction of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline under the Baltic Sea. Understanding for listeners that this our interview is being taped on Wednesday and being played on Friday, what's your take on the president's first pitch at this year's NATO summit?
It's interesting to watch, and there's clearly a disruptive element at play here, and I think we have to take this opening volley of rhetoric with a grain of salt, as with everything coming out of the Trump administration, as to put it generously, art of the deal type stuff, where he's not exactly meaning what he says. So when he suggests NATO allies should start upping their spending commitments to NATO to 4% of GDP on defense, I think that's not going to happen. I don't think he's even expecting it to happen, but it might be a way of trying to get people, nudge people along to the idea of meeting the supposed spending obligation of 2% of GDP that the NATO nations commit to, which is not, of course, happening at this time. But all of this, I think, is just disruptive of the NATO alliance, which I'm very much in accord with. I think NATO is an aging and completely decrepit and meaningless organization, especially now that it's become a truly global, a worldwide thing, for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization to have alliances and associations all across the world, literally in Korea and other places, and dipping its nose into, of course, Afghanistan and far-flung corners of the world. It's obviously nothing other than just a military organization that seeks to really cement and solidify Western global hegemony and at the end of a military a barrel of a gun. So I think it is an organization that needs to go. I don't believe that Trump really wants to bring NATO down, though. If you actually listen to the rhetoric, it's all about how the U.S. is spending too much and the other allies have to spend more. It's primarily a cost concern from the Trump administration rather than, hey, why is NATO in Afghanistan occupying that country for 17 years now? That sort of thing, which seems to be more problematic.
So it's just about his roundabout way of saying, or wouldn't it be more productive if he just gone in there and say, we are spending too much, so instead of us paying 4%, we're going to drop it to 3%.
Well, that's one negotiating tactic. I guess that's not the one he's going with.
I guess not.
I don't claim to be able to read his mind or what's going on there, but apparently this is the push. And we saw that, of course, in the campaign, the 2016 campaign, where he was talking about NATO being obsolete. But then, of course, immediately after he won the election and became president, and then he's going to NATO's new headquarters and saying, it's not obsolete anymore. I was wrong about that. Well, surprise, surprise, like every other candidate ever in the history of elections, lied on the campaign trail to get people to vote for him, thinking he was saying one thing, when in fact he was saying another. All he's saying is that NATO needs to increase its expenditure, which of course is the exact opposite of the direction that I think probably most Americans, let alone most of the world, want to go in.
Well, he's also scheduled to meet with the Queen, Prime Minister Theresa May. He's also going to visit his golf club in Scotland. How do you think that, is that any of importance? Will he have any influence on Brexit? And is that about ready to fall apart? Or can it fall apart at this point?
Well, I mean, there has apparently been some sort of shakeup in the May government there in England, mm-hmm. that is affecting the Brexit freight train. So I don't know. I don't follow the internal British politics that enough to be able to comment on it intelligently. But I do know that there are questions, and there I think have always been questions since Brexit supposedly passed. Well, what does that mean, and what form is it going to take, and how are they going to implement it? Are they going to implement it at all? All valid questions to this day, because again, I think it's one of those things. Well, we can believe it when we see it, and we certainly haven't seen it yet. So I think there's all sorts of question marks surrounding that. I think probably the most interesting part of the Trump visit that's happening right now will, of course, be the Trump-Putin summit in Helsinki, which I think everyone's wondering about. And I think wondering about for good reason, because as far as I know, there's no published or formal agenda to this meeting. There's no topics that have been discussed that are going to be on the table, per se. I'm not sure exactly what this meeting is supposed to be about. And that might be the most interesting part of this, to find out what it is they do discuss, let alone if they come to any sort of major agreements.
Well, there's no note takers. They're on a one-on-one. But, I mean, I believe he's met with Putin before on a one-on-one. He's met with the Chinese premier one-on-one with, you know, no note takers other than the interpreters. I can't remember this was common policy with previous administrations that I recall. So this is sort of a, you know, something new. And there was an article earlier this week that asked whether Trump is little more than Putin's puppet. Is Putin Trump's handler?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, again, this goes back to all the Russian collusion brouhaha, which I think I would assume most of your audience understands has to be taken with that gigantic grain of salt, being basically one of the excuses that was used for the absolute abysmal train wreck of the Clinton campaign in 2016. And suddenly, after she lost the election, it was all the Russians, the Russians, the Russians. So I think we have to take this as part of the just political left-right back-and-forth nonsense that doesn't really indicate a whole lot. But again, it will be interesting to see what, if anything, actually eventuates from this summit, what they discuss. Do they agree anything? That will be much more interesting to me than the question that Putin is some sort of Svengali puppeteering the Trump administration.
Okay. Going on, trade wars. Let's mosey on into that. You recently wrote about what you call the eerie parallels between trade war that deepened the Great Depression and set the world on the path to World War II and our current situation. Would you like to comment on your article that you wrote?
Yes. Well, this was in the International Forecaster a week or two ago, and what I was pointing to was the story of the Smoot-Hawley tariffs that came in 1930, just after, of course, the Black Monday Black Day in October 29, the crash of 1929, and the real onset of the Great Depression. And so, of course, what were the politicians clamoring for? Well, we'll use tariffs to make sure that we protect. At that time, it was agricultural workers and their livelihood. At this time, it's manufacturing. But the parallels are numerous and ominous, really, because what we discover is that the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, this wide-ranging tariff that was imposed on all sorts of goods, over 20,000 goods when this tariff was passed, suddenly became, the average price raise was 59.1%, and there were a number of goods that actually the price quadrupled overnight. So I think that tells us a couple things. One is that tariffs have to be seen as a tax. They are a tax on the people of the country that is imposing the tariffs. So Trump is imposing a tax on a number of people. And of course, the people who are hit the hardest by this will be the people at the absolute bottom rung of the economic ladder, because they're going to be the ones who tend to rely on the cheap Chinese imports to make ends meet so that they can actually afford, you know, basic goods. Well, those are exactly the products that are targeted by this. So I think we have to keep that in mind. The other part is that one of the other things about the Smoot-Hawley tariffs is that it really kicked off, or at least put into high gear, a round of tariffs and counter tariffs and a sort of trade war that was happening around the world at that time. paradoxically enough, the 1920s, I think, is seen as a sort of a boom time. Certainly in the United States, we think of the Roaring Twenties. And then even in Europe, I mean, it was reconstructing from World War One. And hey, reconstruction is good for business. There's lots of, you know, money to be made there. But counterintuitively, everyone was basically shutting their doors to trade and investment in the 1920s because of the reparations, for example, that Germany was paying and things like this that could really only be settled reasonably in exchange of goods, because no one really had the gold to really make reparation payments. So they were exchanging goods primarily as the way of paying off reparations. Well, the other trading partners of Germany said, well, that's not going to work out very well for us. So they started imposing tariffs, and there were counter tariffs. The Smoot-Hawley tariffs really kicked that into high gear, and we saw essentially a beggar thy neighbor round of tariffs and tit for tat protectionist policies go into place in the 1930s that really did contribute. Not only did it worsen, lengthen, and deepen the Great Depression, as basically all economists will tell you today, but also it really did set the world on the path to World War II. And then we get this narrative that it was World War II that saved us from the Great Depression. I mean, that's the great narrative that we're fed, and I was fed it in school in Canada. I'm sure many of your listeners were fed the same thing. We were in this Great Depression, but World War II came along, and suddenly, of course, we had full employment and booming manufacturing for the war machine, and everything was good and dandy again. Well, that notion itself has been debunked for people who don't know about it, and I link in my article to an article from Mises.org on World War II did not end the Great Depression, to put it succinctly enough. And this works on, it draws on the work of Robert Higgs talking about Leviathan, and basically the idea is, no, it wasn't World War II that pulled the world out of the Great Depression, or the United States specifically. It was the end of World War II, when all of the strictures and restrictions and all of the rationing and all of that was put into place by the American government in the war period was taken off. And suddenly you had this flowering, this, and all of these regulations and things were suddenly taken off, restrictions, tariffs, all of this, and you had this huge flowering of productive and commercial activity. And that's where you can really date it from. All of the economic figures from the war itself are heavily skewed and don't point to the fact that you couldn't go out and just buy, you know, bread and eggs and butter and basic, absolute basic goods that you take for granted because of all the restrictions and limits and rationing and all of that was going on. It was not a regular economic environment. It wasn't until all of that was lifted and all of the kind of things that were put in place during the Great Depression, the Great Society nonsense of FDR, when that was started to pull that apart, suddenly you had this flowering of industry and manufacturing and production and consumption that led to the 50s and the incredible expansion of commercial activity that went on there. So I think we have to understand this history, not because we need, you know, a history lesson, but because this is relevant to today. If we believe that the only thing that will pull us out of a depression is a great war, people will be more inclined to go along with the great war when it is presented to them if this trade war continues along the path that it's on for the next few years.
But are the wars different now because of the amount of debt that is purchased by other countries? And I have another question. When Smoot-Hawley was introduced, when those tariffs were introduced, was the economy at that time at the same pace as we are today? Is the timing the same? If I'm clear on
right.
My question.
Are we running up against the break?
Let's go ahead and take the break, and then you can answer that when we get back. So we're going to take this short break, and I'll be back with James Corbett right after these brief messages. Won't you lay it on the line? I need to hear it just one more time. Oh, won't you tell me again? Oh, can you feel it? Oh, won't you tell me again tonight? Each and every heart is
food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value. value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my guest, James Corbett. And heading into the break, we were talking about the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. And my question to James was the economy at that point in time that was introduced at the same place as our economy is today, when you take into consideration of the debt levels? And, you know, I don't believe our economy is as strong as what they tell us it is. And I saw, was it the Georgia Fed came out today and said, oh, they're expecting second quarter GDP to be 3.8 or something. And it's, it could be, but, so that was my question.
Right, yes. And it is a good question because it points out some of the differences. Obviously, there are parallels here, but there are differences. And one of them is that the Smoot-Hawley tariffs were introduced in 1930, i.e. after the crash had begun and after the Depression was already starting to set in. So obviously, that's different than our situation today, where I think you and I probably do agree we're in a bubble, an everything bubble, really, of sorts here. But the bubble has not burst yet, not spectacularly. So it is different in that sense. In fact, really, I mean, global trade was looking up and up, and there was all sorts of projections of expansion of global trade and things like that coming into the new year this year, which has been derailed somewhat by these trade wars, and we'll have to see what further eventuates from them. But that, I think, is a significant difference. Whereas in the Smoot-Hawley time in 1930, the U.S. I mean, for one thing, U.S. exports at that time were predominantly agricultural. So this had a huge effect on the agricultural industry in the United States, which at that time employed most workers. Well, obviously, that's changed dramatically over the past 70 years and 80 years. In fact, not just from agricultural to manufacturing, but then manufacturing to services, which is one of the primary drivers of employment in this day and age. And so there's a lot of differences at that level that we could look into. I think it's just the overall trend of where things develop from here, if this does eventuate into a trade war, is what I find disturbing. At least it gives us pause for thought about the way that this could unfold into something much larger than just a trade issue. And people who just you know, rally around the flag and rah 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 America because we're going to win this trade war, I don't think it's always quite as straight a line as that. And generally, the people who get hurt the most in these types of wars, as in every type of war, I would venture to say, are again the people at the bottom of the power pyramid who end up getting crushed under the wheels of this gigantic machinery that's rolling over them right now.
You know, James, I read comments from people who say they support these tariffs, even though the farmers, they're getting hurt. But they're supporting this, the move, thinking that it's good for this country. And they're willing to take the hit.
Yes.
But I don't think they really understand, though.
Well, I think it is important to understand that there is an argument to be made that, of course, the U.S. has lost so much of its manufacturing productive capacity over the last several decades of outsourcing that it is becoming a national security concern. I mean, when countries start getting to the point where all of their basic goods are being imported, then obviously they are much more vulnerable to any sort of disruption in that supply. So in the event that, you know, 20 years down the line, who knows how different the situation might be, and maybe China could effectively say, all right, well, we'll stop trade with you and you guys will just basically starve to death because you can't do anything by yourselves anymore. That could be a concern. And there are things like that to take into account. And of course, there are people who want to go back to some sort of 1950s heyday where everyone could get employed in manufacturing and have a nice stable career and a home and picket fence and three kids and a dog and a boat for the weekends kind of thing. I'm not sure that's going to come back, but that's kind of what people are, I think, looking at and looking to when they start talking about, well, American manufacturing. From my perspective, I think it's fine if people want to support American-made goods and all of that. If the Americans want to support their own native industry, that's great. That's fine. That's totally their decision. But it should be their decision. And if you're willing to pay more to purchase local, then that's great. Good for you. But some people aren't. And some people can't. And that's the people who generally get crushed under these types of things. And so it's kind of strange that people who are going to ultimately end up suffering the most tend to be some of the most vocal supporters of these policies.
And we have to, you know, question how much are they willing to pay. You know, they might pay now because it's only a 10% increase, but when it's 30, 40, and 50%, you know, that's another story because, as you said, it does affect different groups of people differently. You also wrote another article, The Global Economy Between a Rock and a Hard Place, and you begin with, well, it's official. Japan Inc. is now Bank of Japan Inc. Would you like to bring the listeners your thoughts on your article?
Yes, interesting. Absolutely. Yes. Well, for people who don't know, the Bank of Japan has been on a stock buying spree for the last several years. And it's not a direct, they are not directly buying stocks. They're buying ETFs, i.e. buying into funds, essentially Tokyo Stock Exchange listed companies. But that purchasing has gotten to the point, I believe 25 trillion yen, that's a quarter of a trillion dollars worth of exchange traded funds in the past 8 years. That means that the Bank of Japan is now one of the top 10 shareholders in 40% of the companies listed on the Tokyo Stock Exchange, 1,446 companies out of 3,735. They are a top 10 shareholder. There are some in which the Bank of Japan is now actually the top shareholder, which is crazy to think about. It is the central bank that is just basically raining this money into the markets, and they are now becoming a significant player in the markets because of that that money that they're pumping in there, just trying to get inflation going and trying to buoy up Japanese industry and companies. It's working, I suppose, in a sense. There has been an expansion in the Japanese economy and in the corporate profits of a lot of these listed companies that are at the very least making money off of their stocks. But the problem is that the BOJ, the Bank of Japan, has painted itself into a corner. They can't really stop doing this now because the markets have become so hooked on the juice that they keep shoving in there. But as one of the Bank of Japan board member pointed out in an interview recently, he said bond and stock prices would decline and the yen would appreciate if they actually tried to reverse this tide, if they started trying to raise interest rates and take some of that money back. So they can't do anything. They just have to keep doing more of the same. And we all know it's a bubble at this point and it's going to burst. You cannot have the central bank just becoming the owner of the economy unless you are literally living in some sort of socialist or communist state. Theoretically, that's not what Japan is, but it's becoming more and more so by default. So and I think this is interesting, not just from the Japanese perspective, obviously for people in Japan, it's quite interesting. But I think on the global scale, this does represent a lot of the problems that the entire global economy is facing right now, including the question of how do you reverse some of this this quantitative easing madness, the various forms of that central banks around the world have been doing for several years. The European Central Bank still has to deal with these types of issues. And of course, the Fed is already starting to reverse and go and raise interest rates. But that's creating the global debt trap, where the raising interest rates are, of course, causing all of these emerging markets where people were borrowing in dollar-denominated funds to basically have to cash in and put their money back because it's just becoming untenable to keep paying these debts in dollars because they're losing more and more money as the dollar gains strength. And this is a snowball. And unfortunately, again, we like it or not, we are in this globally internet-connected economy now, where if there starts to be an emerging market debt contagion, that could very easily affect Japan. That could very easily affect the United States. That could very easily start to affect other corners of the globe as well. So, unfortunately, this is the type of snowball rolling downhill that we definitely do not want to add any steam to, metaphorically speaking, to mix metaphors there. So, it's a extremely delicate situation, and it's not apparent from within the boundaries of this system and the way it's constructed. It's not apparent there is really a way out of this other than keep blowing up that bubble and hope that some magical miracle economic savior comes along to actually expand out the economy to fill up that bubble. But, you know, barring some sort of miraculous zero point energy, whatever, 21st century something, it's unlikely that we're going to reach that kind of economic capacity. So what goes up must come down, and it's going to be a hard landing.
And you know what's fascinating is everyone knows this, and yet there's no reactions to anything.
Yeah.
It's just
everything
just markets, moves smoothly along. It's like
that's so important because the market, theoretically, the idea of the markets is that they should at least be a bellwether of sentiment and of what people are thinking and reactions. It should provide a sort of a weather vane for, oh, when this geopolitical event occurs and look at what happened in the markets, that shows that it's going to have this effect. And it's a way of finding out more about the world. Essentially, it's about information. But that has been broken by this because now people aren't really reacting to news in the way that you would expect them to. You would expect some sort of cataclysmic event to mean, oh, people will sell off. They're going to try to hoard money. They're going to try to play it safe, go to flight to safety, put it in the treasuries or something like that.
Gold,
sure, of course, exactly. If we're talking realistically here, but who's talking realistically anymore? unfortunately, that has become so broken that it's now almost the reverse in many cases. I've talked about this before, the kind of flipping of reality where bad economic news is generally a sign, oh, people will buy into the markets because they know the central banks are going to come along to save the day with manna from heaven. So it's got the exact opposite incentives going right now, and it's just insanity. I mean, it's totally flipped from real reality. And again, I mean, we've been saying it for years. Who knows how many more years we could continue saying it, but it's true, and everyone knows it to be true. The markets are broken. The system is broken. It's rigged, and it's just a matter of time until the piper comes to collect the debts. The only question is what form that takes and who ends up on top of the debt pile, the heap, once the smoldering remains are there to be sorted out. And those questions, I suppose, could be up in the air, but the question of that this is coming is not really up in the air to anyone who's seriously looking at the situation.
You know, you were talking about Japan's central bank, and they're going to continue to buy into the shares, and they can't stop. They're going to keep going, and it's the people of Japan, the people of the United States, they have it just doesn't seem to matter. And I guess this goes along with what you just said. They're just willing to accept it because they just don't know. There's no alternatives.
Well,
they're just riding the wave. They're riding.
There's another aspect to this, which is that essentially economics is a shared, it can be a shared reality or a shared delusion. And as long as everyone is sharing the delusion, even if they know it is illusory, even if they know it's not real, as long as everyone acts as if it is real, it is self-sustaining. And what I mean by that, I mean everyone knows that the pieces of paper you have in your wallet is really just pieces of paper. It's not in itself anything intrinsically valuable, and you can't even go and exchange it for gold anymore. So it really is just pieces of paper. How can it be that I give this piece of paper and I get a good? It's because everyone understands and agrees to accept those pieces of paper, and okay, so we will treat it as if it has value, so it has value. And that, I think, applies more generally. When we're looking at the markets in more abstract terms, everyone knows that the whole situation is rigged and that all of this is just funny money that's being created out of nowhere and injected into the economy by banks. But Well, we all agree that this is all money and wealth, quote unquote. So we'll just act as if it is, and it will become a reality because we are all invested in that reality, literally and figuratively.
I like that title, Shared Reality, Shared Delusions. It makes us sane people insane, you know, because we all know, and it's just like we want some reaction, not that we, you know, are looking for bad things to happen.
Of course, exactly. That's the other thing about this. A lot of times people might think that we are excited for this or we want it to happen, but no, we're trying to warn people it is coming in the exact same way there were people screaming their heads off about the housing bubble a decade plus now, and people were laughing at them, literally, like Peter Schiff on those programs I'm sure we've all seen on YouTube, literally laughing at him. Oh, you think the housing market's in a bubble? If people had been listening to him rather than laughing, there might have been a lot more people who would have escaped the calamitous events that occurred in the great fallout of 2007-2008. So again, this is more about letting people know reality so they can prepare for it rather than living in that shared delusion.
I mean, Larry Kudlow, President Trump's economic advisor, I think he still denies the housing bubble. I think, you know, so it really is amazing. And you know, again, the 2015 devaluation of China's currency, I mean, the markets came unglued temporarily, gold went flying and so forth, and look at their currency today. And it's again, it doesn't seem that anything really matters. We're running out of time. We're just about end of the program today. Are there any final thoughts you'd like to add?
I suppose not. Again, I just want people, I think the fundamental point of what I'm trying to go at here and what I've been going at recently in the Forecaster is to say that I think they're going to try at some point to offer war as some sort of solution to all of this. Again, even if we know that it's all a bubble and it's all going to burst, well, one way out of it is war. And I think people are being prepped in various ways to accept warfare as something that will be good and cleansing and help the economy in some way. That's all a lie. And of course, wars are only ever fought for the benefit of the people at the very top of the system, and the people who get killed are generally the people at the very bottom. So do not support the next war that they try to corral us all into for whatever noble sounding ideas that they trot out in front of the public. It's always based on lies, and I think we have to be prepared for that as the next shoe to drop after the trade war.
Alrighty. Thank you, James. As always, we appreciate your views and insights. We'll talk to you again next week. And I want to thank everyone for tuning in today. Don't forget to call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. Thank you, and have a great day, and we'll be back tomorrow.
There never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.